Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025.
Today, technical analysis of financial statements. This is a cleanup of the work that I did on Monday with you, looking at the case of a corporation, in our instance, Kroger, going through the ratios, talking about what they're telling us and what the implications of this are, for example, on long-term survivability of the company, investment quality of the company, and all of that comes out of this. Before I go there, we do have a quiz today, and it is not in the Respondus Lockdown browser. Remember that. I gave up on that. As far as the quiz goes, once you've done your attendance radar, you stow your mobile phones away, and as per the syllabus, you can't sit in the far back row because then we can't see your screens as we proctor the exam. Oh, one thing about attendance radar, if you have a personal email address in there, make sure you go in and change that to your ISU email address, because otherwise we can't transfer records and you miss attendances that way. But other than that, we will do the quiz as soon as, I can't remember when it starts, but it shouldn't be too bad for you. It's not a bad quiz. Well, you might think it is, but it looks like it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Okay. Let me go up here, get everything set up for you. Oh, two. Yeah, day seven. Okay. Yeah. And once you finish with the quiz, just you can leave. Be sure to keep quiet while you're getting out, because other people might still be taking it. Okay. Before we do that, let's look at the numbers and have just a quick look at the numbers. I want to show you a couple of things here real quick on these. The first thing is that, as you can see, Asia was bullish today, or bullish last night. However, and by the way, these are fair game for quizzes and exams, the trading symbols, what market this is. So Nikkei and Hang Seng, those are Asian, so that means that we would be looking at the pulse of the economic situation as assessed by the markets in Asia, looking at Hang Seng and the Nikkei. And in both of these cases, as you can see, the Nikkei had a strong, constantly upward momentum all day long. There was good information pouring in all through the day. The Hang Seng was a little bit different. It kind of lost its momentum at about the midday, a little earlier than the midday, and then it just sort of floated along for the rest of the day. Still up for the day, though. Now, we go over here, and just having a look at a couple. One thing is the Euro index, skidded slowly downward through the day. It started out good, but then it eroded. It wasn't anything spectacularly down. It wasn't a huge day down, but it was just one of those kind of grouchy days. Similarly, the London FTSE 100 showed that same sort of, started out good, and then it just sort of wore out, and there was more bad news than good news, so it slid down into the earth, as it were. And if we go over here, we had, the Dow was down, not spectacularly, but it was noticeably down, about 0.5%. Oddly, the S&P 500 was up for the day, sort of bucking what was happening to the big dogs. But NASDAQ, it was also down. Was it NASDAQ down? Yeah. No, it actually finished up a tiny bit just before the close. You can see on that spark chart, it had a little bit of a buy. Some bulls came in and pushed it above where it started. So, real good news, I guess, there. And the VIX, it's starting to show more volatility. We're getting to that point where there's concern. Trading is just for the moment. That's all they do, is whatever is the meal right in front of them, they grab. If it's a good meal, then the market goes up. If it's a bad meal, it goes down. That's the day-to-day activity of the traders. They don't think long run until it begins to worry them. And there is, in the back rooms, a great deal of concern about the state of the economy. If we are not in a recession already, we will be within one soon enough. And there are a couple of forces that are going to be coming along in the next month, 2 months, that will exacerbate that situation. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit. But I want to introduce you to a new, one more index. This is CAC 40. That one is sort of like the European equivalent of the Dow. Very large, 40 very large companies. You know, Michelin, Renault, L'Oreal, these just giants of Europe. And so this, looking at this one, is sort of like seeing the Dow of the European markets. What is happening to the big dog companies as far as the market's assessments of their future success or failure. Now, obviously, these are huge companies. They're not going to fail, but they are buffeted back and forth by macroeconomic trends. They don't really have competitors per se in the sense of like monopolistic competitors in the S&P 500, but they are not immune to the macroeconomic situation in Europe, in the Eurozone. So this is one we'll have a look at every now and then over the next few months, just to see what Europe, how they're reacting to the world events that are going on. Coming down here, just to have a quick look at it, we see crude and the crude oil is just all crude, the average price per barrel of all crude. Everything from the sourest of sludge up through to the light sweets of the world. And so it is sort of the average, the light, this Brent, that is the good stuff. And so it will naturally tend to be above the overall price per barrel of oil. And they do, however, behave pretty much the same way. You'll see these patterns look very similar from day to day. And more than anything else, we kind of look at the spread and things like that. But here's the thing. These are cheap, and I will say this over and over again. These are extraordinarily low prices for oil. And we should actually be seeing lower gasoline prices than what we are now. There's a little bit of disagreement on why that is, but we should probably be seeing oil prices already down $2.89 a gallon. Anyway, that's not going to last for long. It's not going to last more than a year or so. What's going on is the big oil-producing countries, Saudi Arabia, those kinds of countries, they are pouring oil into the market. They are cranking out oil as hard as they can. In the refineries, there's massive amounts of oil. Back down the line on the high seas, the very large dirties and the smaller oil tankers are just full of oil going here and there. Reserve tanks all over the Middle East and other places are full of oil. They're glutting the market. And why are they glutting the market? Because at these prices, they're going to completely wreck the rest of the oil industry. The wildcatters, the small landmen, all those are going to be gone. This drill baby drill, No one's going to do that because everyone is going out of business now. Bankruptcies are skyrocketing in the oil patch because of all these drillers. It's not even worth it to fix a well that needs a workout. It's just not worth it. And so you're going to have a collapse of the supply from alternatives to the OPEC nations. And once they have done that, then they'll turn off the oil and the price will go to $90, $100 a barrel. How do we know this? Well, you just look at the production numbers in the Middle East. How else do we know it? Because they did the same damn thing about 6 years ago. They did the same thing. They just glutted, oil prices went down, gas prices went down, and then once all the wildcatters and all the small operations were wrecked, well, then they just turned it around. They brought the price of gas. They brought the supply down, and the prices skyrocketed. That is just a cycle. They do it. We know how it works. There's no law against them doing it. These are free international markets. And so the other side of this will come in time, but not today. So buy your gasoline, maybe put some in a couple of big barrels and drums or something like that, because it won't last. This is just how the world that I was in, this is just how it's done. Anyway, enough of that. I want to show you something a little different here just for a couple of minutes. There's a thought that you invest in the stock market, and you think about American companies, but what about foreign companies? Can you invest, buy stock of a Japanese car manufacturer, for example? The answer is actually yes, you can. You can buy the stock of I never spell that right the first time. Hyundai. Whoa, that is an expensive stock. Hello, Kitty. Oh, goodness. And it's not because the company is so valuable. It's just that there aren't a lot of the shares out there. Let me find something that's a little more realistic. That's just stupid. Okay. I could do Samsung. I was going to do Mitsubishi, but let me type in Samsung, see if I can pull a... Well, here's the thing. Oh, they're expensive too. That's good. You stay out of my investment portfolio management. Okay, here's the thing though, is this really isn't the stock of Samsung or Hyundai or Mitsubishi. Those are what are called ADRs. See that? That gives you the clue, that string of numbers in a parenthesis after the name of the company. An ADR is an American Depository Receipt. An American Depository Receipt. Essentially, it is a security, a stock, that is a mirror image of the actual stock of the company, which can't be sold here. Samsung stock, you can't buy real Samsung stock, but you can buy a mirror image. This is really a simplistic way of explaining it, but it is just a mirror image of it. It's a security that is registered with our SEC, but when you buy a share of that you see there on the screen, you are not automatically then an owner of Samsung. See, when you buy stock, you become an owner of the company. A very minor owner, probably, but you become an owner. That's what's different about this. It moves like the company does. Its stock goes the same. It's doing the same thing. It's just that it is not truly ownership in Samsung, in this case you see here. But that doesn't mean it's not a worthy investment. You can certainly internationalize your portfolio by putting in ADRs. they go up and down. They're just stock. And if it doesn't really bother you that you can't vote for the directors and things like that, you're not really an owner, if that doesn't bother you, then ADRs are something that you can put into your portfolio to sort of internationalize it and therefore suppress some of what we call the diversifiable risk of the portfolio. And I'll get into that a lot more later. But do appreciate that these stocks are out there and they're worth having a look at. And it just understanding, of course, as I'm getting you to do here, that it isn't the actual company. But who cares if it's going to go up, then I'm going to buy it. If it's going to go down, I'm going to dump it. So, in other words, if I were to put in here, I don't know. Let me put it, Mitsubishi. Let's put one and show you. Let me show you this one. Mitsubishi, folks normally think of Mitsubishi as just a car company. It makes a decent range of cars. They're not terribly attractive, but they are pretty good value. If you see this dark blue Mitsubishi driving around town with a guy with a beard, that's probably me. But the thing is that Mitsubishi is that's Mitsubishi Financial. Let me get the true Mitsubishi. There it is. And again, notice that weird set of numbers. That's a giveaway that this is probably an ADR or something like an ADR. There are some things that are sort of like ADRs, but they're slightly different. But the thing of it is, Mitsubishi is not a car company. It is an industrial conglomerate. There is Mitsubishi Car, Auto, Mitsubishi Heavy, which is machinery like cranes and dump trucks and all that kind of stuff. There are other arms of Mitsubishi. It's a complex, large, very old corporation. So when you grab, if you are looking for something that is more of a conglomerate, that has its hands in all manner of anything mechanical, this is one of those companies that you might want to look at. And notice down here, by the way, that we can look at these companies the same way that we can look at American stocks. It has a beta. It's relatively low risk, well, quite low risk. It is certainly it's undervalued, and its earnings per share are stupidly high. It's profitable as all get out, and it pays a nice fat dividend. Now, $110 looks like a lot, but of course, you have to look at that compared to the price of the stock, which is $3,453. But that's something to keep in mind, that sometimes it helps if you're looking for companies that are very large. They're not going to die, but they're very large. This is where you look. Now, one more thing that I want to point out here. Notice the chart of Mitsubishi. This is the day's trading. Notice how it has this kind of blocky look to it. Let me give you Ford here and let you see a company like Ford. Do you see how it doesn't have that blockiness? It's more just spike up and down and up and down than Mitsubishi. Here's why. When you see a stock that has, let's try that again. When you see a stock that has this blockiness to it, and here's one, let me do Toyota. Again, see that odd? It doesn't look the same as an American stock's price movements. Here's why. There are not as many trades going on with these ADRs. There is a block trade, and then there's nothing for a while. Then there's another block trade, and then nothing happens for a while. That's why you'll see more of that choppiness that is in these. Let me do one more. Let's do Isuzu. Isuzu Motor. Is there okay, there hasn't been any training today in it. This is one of the things that you do have to deal with these foreign stocks, is that they don't have that volatility, that up and down, that is characteristic of American companies. And since I'm on the subject of auto companies, let me show you Ford here for a second. I want to make a mention of something about Ford. Ford fell off the face of the earth this morning, but you know, that's the way it is. Here's the thing about it. If you look at a company like Ford, let me take it out here for a year. There's something about car companies like Ford, and GM has the same thing. They tend to stay in a certain range. Ford never goes above $12 or $13 a share. It never goes below a certain amount either. This is a characteristic, and let me show you General Motors too, GM. Let me look 1 year on it. You notice that it just kind of stays in this band. It never goes up and stays up. It just keeps bouncing up and down. This is a characteristic of companies that don't have anything that is new that would elevate the value of the corporation in a semi-permanent way. That is one of the reasons that we suspect that one or the other, possibly both, Ford and GM, will no longer be here within about 5 to 7 years. They just are not going anywhere. And unless they can find a way to make alliances with some car company that will help them elevate their game, the older and more astute and usually correct analysts are saying one of these isn't going to make it over the 5 to 7 year period. Maybe neither of them will, because if they ever got their act together, it would be in a long-term situation. By then, the car industry will have changed so much that they will again be behind the curve as far as technologies go. And so that's where we sit now. So have a look over a long period of time. Does this company actually have bad times? But does it surge to new levels and stay up there in those new levels? If the answer is no, that's a company that it's a dead man walking, but it won't stop walking for some years to come. These are more long-term analysis that I'm giving you here. Anyway, that's enough of the doom and gloom stuff for the day. What I wanted to do in this one is, for now, is I wanted to bring up the financial statements that I brought out for you before. And I've done a few tweaks, and I'll put some more tweaks in here, make sure all my numbers are right, and I'll re-upload this tonight. It's in Canvas, Files, Spreadsheet, and then there's a subdirectory called Class Spreadsheets. And that's where I'll put this once I've finished it. So don't panic and try to do everything I'm doing along the way here. And before I get started on this, I do want to make a caution. When you are doing a research project or a term paper in a class here at ISU in your last couple of years, some companies, you want to look at their financial statements. Be cautious. What can happen is that you can walk into what sounds like a normal company, and then you go to its financial statements, and something is wrong with them. And then you're scrambling. Right now, my Business 100 students are doing their Milner Library research project, and each group has to tell me a company that they're going to investigate. And I say, you have to tell me. Don't just charge into it. You tell me, and I might very well say, don't do that. And it's because there is something weird in the financial statements that kind of messes up the analysis. Let me give you an example here. Let me go over here to SEC.gov. See if I can actually chase it over here. Didn't mean to do that at all. What happened there? There it is. Let me drag it over here. Why is it not acting? Oh, there it is. Okay. I'm going to go to sec.gov/search-filings. I think this is how I can get there fast. Yeah, search filings. I'm going to pull up Target, TGT. Now, you can't download the Excel sheets anymore. Thank you for doing that to us, SEC. But here we go, filings. And I'm going to look at the interactive data. I just want to show you something in the financials. Okay. Why does this suck? Company search. Filings, let's try it one more time, TGT, Target Corporation. And let me go over here to the 10Ks. And here's the 10K right here, filing. Okay, interactive data. That's what I want to see, financial statements. Let me show you the balance sheet and challenge you. That's the income statement. Is there any reason they can't just call it a balance sheet? Okay, there we go. There's Target's most recent balance sheet. Do you see something that's missing? Now, I won't hold it against you if you don't. You probably don't spend your nights looking at financial statements. But do any of you catch that there's something missing? Hint, look toward the top of those numbers toward the top. Look at the current assets. Is there something that should be there that's not? Anyone? Where's accounts receivable? It's not there. You're saying, now wait a minute, fat boy, maybe that other current assets. No, that wouldn't be. Look at that number. That's tiny compared to the other numbers there. That's a small number. That could not be accounts receivable. And besides which, what other is just a miscellaneous thing. When they say other in financial statements, that's just a bunch of little things all packed together. This financial statement, this balance sheet, does not report, yeah.
Is it not on the balance sheet because they can't get a number, thus they can't report it?
Oh, that would require that they, that's actually happened. They would have to be very quick to disclose that, an 8K even. And then they would immediately have to file a Form 10K/A, an amendment. But you're right, that has happened in the past. And it's like, oh, don't do that. That's a bad thing to do. Matter of fact, there was a company last year that actually missed an entire filing because it didn't have some of the data. Hell broke loose. The SEC just paddled them. Here's what's going on with Target. You have to dig around. Remember that item 7, management discussion and analysis? And this is what happened with me. I pulled it up right in front of a class. Well, we're going to do this from scratch. And then I slammed into this wall. I thought, where the hell is the accounts receivable? The first thing I did was I went to the Form 10K itself. Item 7, management discussion and analysis of the results of financial operations. And I looked, and it took me like about 10 minutes. There it was. Oh, our accounts receivable are all owned by this captive sock puppet over here. So we don't report them because this sock puppet has those accounts receivable. And I thought, that's got to be phony. No, it can be done, and more corporations are doing this now, where they have something on their financial statements, especially on the balance sheet, that they say is actually owned by another company, so they don't are not under an obligation to report it. And then you say, well, that's, you have to report it. And they say, well, we do. We tell you about it in the Form 10K. Just go down there a couple hundred pages and look around and you'll find where the numbers are. But again, though, that's clearly a new trick. And if you're going to grab a company just to do research on it for a paper that you're writing or something like that, go through the financials first and make sure all of the numbers that you think should be there are really there. Just a caution to you on this. But there's Target for you. Now, that doesn't mean it's a bad company or it's an evil company. It's just that they... You might want to ask, okay, why are you doing this? Well, it increases shareholder wealth by having some captive do this part of our operations. Maybe so. But at the same time, it sure does look a little bit phony when you're looking at financial statements and something that should always be there, like accounts receivable, isn't there. So it's a cautionary tale on that. Let me kill this off. Now, we're going to go back to this for a little bit here. And I went through, we can see that Kroger, this is Kroger, has kind of been on an uproll. Certainly, they have had their gross margin, their profit margin has been improving. It's a strong company, obviously. Now, then we see their total asset turnover has slowed a little bit. Now, it's nothing exciting, but there were a couple of things here. Debt management. Here is a clue that something interesting is going on. Their debt to total assets has increased by almost half. In other words, they are leveraging the company. More of their capital structure is debt, and therefore less is equity. They are getting more heavier on debt. Now, two things about debt. First of all, debt makes the company riskier. As the leverage goes up, the company gets riskier because it's got larger interest expenses, and therefore it is the operating income has a higher threshold it has to exceed. In other words, their earnings before interest and taxes has to be sufficiently high to handle that extra amount of interest expense that they have to pay now. That's the downside. The upside is what we call gains to leverage. Gains to leverage is the mathematical phenomenon that as a company becomes more leveraged, the return on equity increases. In fact, a little later in this course, I'm going to show you how you could become millionaires. It's done all the time, but you take the risk because it has the whole trick in gains to leverage is something called OPM. OPM. Has anyone heard the term OPM before? Other people's money. And it sounds like it's funny, it is not. You see, because debt, when you take on debt, there's a fixed amount you pay back. You pay back interest that's fixed, and you pay back the original principal that's fixed. But if the asset gains a lot in value because you've put so much money into it, that it's mostly other people's, then the little bit of money you put into it becomes magnified. That's the gains to leverage. It's done in creative financing and real estate all the time. And there are countless thousands of millionaires who did this trick by taking a little bit of their own money and a lot of borrowed money from banks, and they threw it into real estate. And if the real estate goes up in value, then they pay back a fixed amount to the banks, and they just keep all of the gravy that built up during the price appreciation. That's what companies do. And in this case, let's do something here. I left out, and I did this deliberately, there are two profitability ratios that we want to look at here right now. The first one is return on assets, ROA. The other one is return on equity, ROE. Now, return on assets is equal to, you take your net income, which is 2665 here, divided by your total assets. So you scoot over here to the balance sheet and find your total assets. Where the heck are they? Really? Come on. There they are. 52,616. And you get a number. So the return on assets to this company is a modest 5%. Return on equity is you take the same net income, how much the company earned, 2665. You divide that only by the total shareholder's equity, which is only a piece of total assets. Remember, equity plus liabilities equals total assets. So you're dividing by a smaller number. And as you can see, yeah, their ROE is much higher than their total assets. This is a classic quiz or exam question. Which is larger, ROA or ROE? It's obviously always going to be ROE. Now let's look at what's been going on with this for the past, since last year. Notice that the return on assets actually has gone up just a tiny bit. But look at the return on equity. It has almost doubled. Why? Leverage. They're leveraging the company, making it more debt-laden and less owner-laden, and that has the effect of making the owners get a bigger amount of money. The return goes up. This is classic, the gains to leverage. You're seeing what that means. You use more debt, your return on equity will go up. Whether you're a giant corporation like Kroger, or a little operation buying houses on credit and using only a little bit of equity in your purchases. That's the gains to leverage playing itself out right here in real time for all of us to see. And is that bad? Well, as long as Kroger, let me go over here to the income statement. I'm looking for something and I probably won't find it, of course, obviously. Notice how their interest payments from 2024 to 2025 went up. That it'll go up a lot more as that debt begins to soak in and they're making those bigger interest expenses. But the whole thing of it is here that this number, operating profit, is the money that has to be there to pay the interest expense. And as you can see, as long as their operating profit is going up, they can afford the bigger interest expense. So it's not wrong of them to do this. But with a bigger interest expense, they have to make sure that operating income retains a good distance above interest expense. Otherwise, this whole game comes crashing down with gains to leverage. But as long as they're growing their operating income so that they can afford higher interest expenses, this will work. In your lives, you're going to do this almost unconsciously. Right now, almost all of you, none of you could afford a house. I mean, the interest payments alone embedded in those monthly payments would kill you. Because you don't have the income, even if you have barely enough to make your mortgage payments, it's really a dicey game if you lost your job. But later in your life, when you have a lot more income, then you will be more likely to buy a house because you don't have to be afraid of not meeting the mortgage payments. So you'll be doing this too, and you'll get the gains to leverage. You'll own a house. It will probably appreciate in value. So your ROE will be really nice. But you can't do that now because you're not nearly far enough above the mortgage payments with your salaries to be able to handle it. That's what Kroger's doing. They're saying we're growing, we're doing okay, we can afford to use more debt in our capital structure, and therefore we will do good by our shareholders because their return on equity will go up as a result of it. That's what you see in these. Now, do I expect you to be able to do that yet? Absolutely not. But this is sort of one of the things that I want you to understand, sort of in a broad way, what's going on with these companies as they begin to leverage upward, like Kroger is. Other companies don't want to do this. They say, the hell with that. That's dangerous. We might have a bad year, and therefore operating income would suck, and we couldn't make our interest payments. Kroger's saying, no, we're going to do this. We're going to grow. And this is how, by using more debt.